Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of The Wagon with me, Finty Williams, and my illustrious co-host, John McEwen. As always, this is only possible with the help of Abitha Calm, a residential clinic specialising in addictions and mental health. Without their support, this podcast would definitely not have been possible. Today, we're absolutely thrilled and delighted that our guest is Stefan Oldstahl, who is the bassist and guitarist of the rock band Placebo and has recently started Digital 21. The main thing that I feel when I read about you is how incredibly successful you are, but how incredibly honest you've been about your mental health struggles, about depression, about identity, about all those things. Did you get to a stage in your career where you felt brave enough to tackle those subjects?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Yes, I think there's a time, we are ready when we are ready, you know, and that goes for many things in life. Mm. And for me, in terms of being honest about what I was going through, it kind of started, I think, in the mid-90s with my band, with Placebo. I came out as a gay man, which was public, you know, because we were in the press a lot. And it was a very personal thing, which I felt strongly about then. Mm. 'Cause it wasn't that common back then to be out and out. That was kind of the ethos of the band. We never shied away from hiding what we were feeling or our opinions. And the lyrics were quite, still are, heart on the sleeve. Mm. And tackled gender issues, mental health issues, addiction issues. So it was close to our heart, really, and close to our beliefs and our modus operandi. And in terms of my own mental health, it took a long time from me starting my journey into many years of addiction, active addiction, and mental health issues. It probably was a good 20 years of quote-unquote suffering before I felt I was ready to come out. And I think I've mentioned this to John previously, that for me, coming out as a gay man, with the guilt and the shame that I felt that it carried, and the social stigma that it had back then, and not so much now, fortunately, I liken that to the process of me coming out as an addict with mental health issues, because I felt that there was a lot of shame and guilt attached to being an addict and having feeling like handicapped on the inside, you know, which you people don't really see. So it was this kind of invisible, in a way, illness that I had a hard time to accept myself. And then once I was accepting of it and found help, I was very lucky to reach out before it all got too dark. Mm. So that was a process of kind of coming out as an addict, and I felt that I really needed to build up to that. It definitely was something that I had to feel ready to do. Otherwise, I think it would have been too overwhelming, you know, if someone had kind of outed me. So I'm here now, a good few years into recovery, and I think this is something that we all share. It's like if we can share about our experiences and make someone out there feel a little bit less lonely in what they're going through, and perhaps for someone to identify and see that what they're going through is not, it's not the end of the world, you know, and there is help out there, then I think that is all we can do, you know, and I think that's probably why I'm here today.
Mm. I've always wanted to ask, I'm not in a position of being a songwriter whose music touches hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. But when you wrote Without You, I'm Nothing, were you in active addiction then? Or certainly in the start of it?
I guess to put it into context, Placebo's a rock band. And I guess we come from the lineage of, you know, the 70s, you know, from Bowie to Iggy Pop to Lou Reed, and, you know, and almost the Road of X's leads to the Palace of Wisdom. I don't know if I'm quoting that correctly, but we were a young band having a good time, you know, and we were surrounded by a party atmosphere, and it almost was like every night was a Saturday night, you know, if we were performing, having a gig, or being wined and dined. It was basically, we were in an enabling machine. When the band first got signed, we were courted by many labels, and their way of getting us to sign with them was to, hey, come up to our suite, you can order whatever you want. Hey, come into the bathroom, and there were lines racked up, and we could order whatever we wanted.
Really?
Our dealer worked in the label, at the label. And whenever we go for meetings at the label, the fridge would be stocked with beer, you know, and, you know, the label boss would be skinning up. So basically, it was all around. So that was kind of the atmosphere that we were living in for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So to not partake in, you know, this type of lifestyle was seen as out of the norm. And I'm not just talking about the musicians, you know, the industry were well in it as well. I remember our label, every Friday they finished around midday, and then they had a massive party for the whole office, you know, the booze came out and the decks and the PA system. So that was the surroundings that we kind of grew up in as a band. And we had success when I was 20. I was a little baby. You know, so we're kind of thrust into this world, which at once was a sweet shop, and everything was there for us. But at the same time, I was emotionally very unready for it. So I think, you know, we don't become addicts overnight. You know, and I think by the time that we were recording the track you were talking about, that was the second album. Personally, it was the beginning of isolation for me, loneliness, confusion. I felt like I'd been put in a tumble dryer. I didn't know what was up from down, and I didn't really have a chance to figure out who I was before I was wrecking myself, essentially. So it was a long trajectory, but certainly, yes, I mean, when that song was written, things were starting to slip.
Did you get a sense at some stage of, you mentioned the sweet shop, the goodies that were around? Maybe I'll change this question to, when did you feel that you needed the substances to function, to feel okay, to get by, as opposed to having fun?
Yes. I can't speak for all addicts, but I think a lot of us are highly sensitive people. We're affected very easily emotionally about outside factors, about how people perceive us or talk to us, or how we feel, you know, when we wake up in the morning, how we experience, you know, anything from, you know, the weather to music to not having enough sleep, to not eating right. So I could probably classify myself as a highly sensitive person. Oh. So being in a successful band that we were, you know, because I'm not blowing my own trumpet here, but, you know, we were at a level where a lot was expected of us. We had to perform pretty much every night, and we had to put on a brave face and meet a lot of... I mean, there's a lot of industry that you meet, and there's a lot of fans that you meet, and in order to kind of maintain some kind of persona, I suppose, you know, I think as I was growing into this, I didn't know who I was really, and so I was kind of creating this character of somewhat larger than life Stefan, and the pressure I probably put on myself to live up to this person that I thought that I was. Mm-hmm. This person that I had to be on stage pretty much every night. So when it kind of turned from sweets to something of a necessity, probably around 10 years into it or something, I guess, when it became habitual. And if I don't have, you know, what I need, then I won't feel... right. And with that obviously starts to come the hiding, you know, and the dishonesty to myself and to others. And when it was slowly starting to wreck my personal life, relationships around me, so they kind of come hand in hand with when it becomes more of a necessity rather than a pleasure.
That must have been so hard with the kind of world that you were in. Presumably that, you know, the alcohol and the drugs were still flowing. They were, so it must have been very hard to recognize that you were maybe using them differently to other people, or that's quite a scary thing, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, the realization when... it's a little bit feeling hijacked, and there's no one you can call to kind of pay the ransom for you to get out.
Yeah.
Because I do believe that substances, you know, and other behaviors can hijack you. Mm. And essentially, I think that's what they do, because they take over and you have no control over your freedom. It's not scary at first because you normalize it. I normalized it. An addict's brain will always justify. There's a million and one ways you can justify something that's essentially going to kill you. It's completely twisted. It's it doesn't make any sense, you know. And I think that's got to do with, maybe John, you can correct me on this, but the physiology of the brain where... You know, you can see, you know, a pill or a bottle of beer or a line of cocaine, for example, and your whole body is just telling you, you need this to survive. You need this, and nothing is allowed to get in the way. But it is essentially going to kill you. But your brain is telling you that you need it.
Yeah, that summarizes addiction, really, doesn't it? It's that kind of madness of... I don't want to do this anymore. These are my words. But I need to, or I need to today. I need to take that drink, that drug, that line or whatever to be okay, to function. And well, it's bigger than that, isn't it? It's the old word of, you know, denial is not a river in Egypt. And you get all these sorts of sayings in the treatment world. But it's such a compulsion. It's... You know, some people would say they would kill if somebody got in the way of us taking that next drink or drug. And it is to do with physiology. It's to do with compulsion. It's to do with withdrawal. It's all those things. It's that sense of identity. You know, I am this person, and without that, I don't really exist, or I'm not important. So. Yeah, it's a very complex thing, and this is why, of course, you know, many years of in the field of talking about addiction and studies, we still don't really have a clue.
There's also that strange thing of going, I actually dislike who I am fundamentally so much that the only way I can deal with that pain is to have a drink, is to take the pill, is to do the line, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of weird sense of self and lack of self all at the same time.
Exactly. And I guess that's what you were saying, Stefan, in some way, that you know, you're successful, you're up there, right at the top, and yet there's another part of you and how you feel and how you behave that is contradicting that, if that makes sense, that paradox of, God, I'm good versus I'm really struggling, I need help, you know, I'm in the darkness, I don't even want to live anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all those things. And I think that whatever I was on, I was a different person. So when I came down, or the next day, I just didn't know who I was. You know, I just ended up being this empty shell. Mm. I found that I just could not have a conversation with anyone because I didn't know what I thought about anything as wow. when I was sober. So that in itself was very scary. And like you were saying, it became all about self-hate, really. You know, a self-loathing. It's like how, you know, I really don't like what I've become. I really don't like feeling like this. And it's my fault. And to stop is a very scary prospect, because then it actually makes you face yourself. But luckily, I mustered up the courage with help to face myself, essentially, you know, because all of these substances and behaviors, destructive behaviors, they're just kind of there, getting in the way of you, of yourself, and it is possible. I mean, I never thought it was possible to have a life without any of these, you know, destructive behaviors. Mm. And getting clean was like a really unpleasant early morning wake up to begin with. But then, as you don't become an addict overnight, it's like you don't recover overnight either. So it was a time of humility, a time of acceptance, and the odd cross addiction, you know. 20 years of active addiction, you know, I came out of it, and yeah, I turned to other behaviors and other, probably less damaging to myself, cookies, ice cream.
My friend calls them decaf addictions.
Yeah, that works.
It's much better. I'm grateful, you know, for being able to sit here and talk about it. I'd be lying if it had the ups that I used to have, you know, because not the same kind of ups, you know, but definitely not the same downs as I used to have. And the downs were the killer.
Mm. Could you just, if you don't mind, go back to that early days of stopping? So there'd been, of course, I guess, the withdrawal process of the substances coming out of your system. So that's one thing that's difficult to overcome. Mm-hmm. And then there's that kind of, as you say, that realization of maybe some of the things that we've done in our addiction to kind of come to terms of. But what some people describe as the kind of plane or the desert of, what am I going to do now? You know, what am I going to be like? What will they still like me?
Yes. Well, the thing is, like, it's not about them. It's like, am I going to like me? You know. I guess the first positive thing that happened when I sobered up was I had up to this point not done a single sober gig, you know, which were probably up in the 900 and something gigs that I'd done. Mm-hmm. Not sober. So the first gig sober was very strange. But I realized there was a lot more time between each note that I played on my guitar. And I was like, wow, this is amazing, you know? So that kind of control and realization that, you know, I guess it's kind of an awareness and being in the now was the first kind of crack of light coming in. You know, it's like, ah, you know, this is weird. You know, I feel very exposed. You know, there's nothing here to numb my feelings or give me a bit of Dutch courage on stage. Mm-hmm. But I've seen something else and I like it, you know. It's like I can be a better musician. So I guess I was kind of holding on to this small little nuggets of positivity, you know, because in the beginning they weren't many. Because by the end of my active addiction, the only pleasure I had was basically drinking and eating. There was nothing else in my life that I enjoyed, you know, not even my son, you know, my husband, playing music. You know, I was just reduced to a vegetable, really, you know, someone that was just purely existing. And I think the journey wasn't without its bumps, for sure, you know. When I first got sober, I thought that was it, you know. You know, I've kicked this one substance, which was alcohol. I stayed sober for quite a few years. And I thought I was okay. But then I picked up something else. I had a back injury and I got on opioids. And then that quickly turned into not for the pain. You know, it was, you know, right back to my old behaviors of hiding it and taking way too much, you know, because an addict just won't take what it says on the box. So that's when I really wanted to get help to look at my behaviors rather than the actual substance, because it's a mental illness. It's not the actual behavior as such, you know, or the substance. And that was very hard to kick. Pharmaceuticals are just a killer, you know. Withdrawals are just very, very unpleasant. And there was something in it that made me kind of go, I suppose that was my rock bottom. It's like, I do not ever want to feel like this again. And there was times when I had been on holiday with my family and the only pleasure I got was scoring, really, and not being there with my son. And I was like, I don't want to be like this either. So it was a few kind of buffers that made me want to go, I do not want to feel like this again. So anything else is going to be better. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of holding on to that as much as, you know, finding the little rays of light through the cracks kind of thing. But I was determined that I'd done enough damage to myself and to others around me, because we are not alone in this. It spreads to our nearest and dearest and our friends, mm-hmm. which I've also been to, actually. As a friend and family of another addict. So I kind of know what that's like. So I knew that my behavior had damaging consequences to the people around me. So that was another motivation for me to just walk away from something or try to get away from something, not really knowing where I was heading. But it would be better than where I came from.
That blind faith, I guess, people talk about, where, you know, there is an empty space, isn't there, for a while, and that process of trying to fill that space with something good, some sort of self-esteem, some sort of self-worth, and holding on to hope. And just on that issue, what kept you going? What keeps you going, even if we bring it back to today, that idea that I have to maintain my recovery, I have to maintain this, I have to look after myself. What are the things that you do that help you stay on that track, stay sane even?
I think that the general overriding thought that I have when it comes to where I'm at now mentally is acceptance. Acceptance of myself. I am okay. I am enough. And if I'm having a bad day, you know, this too shall pass. It's those are the two things, like acceptance and then this shall pass, however I'm feeling, if it's a bad day. But along with that, I was very fortunate to be around people who knew a lot about addiction and the way out of it. So what I've done, as well as having been to a treatment center, I've just built up my own little toolbox, my recovery toolbox. I found things that work for me, and I've kind of put them in my toolbox, kind of thinking, well, I might be able to use that little thought or that little slogan or, you know, that meditation or that breathing technique or that phone number, you know, or knowing that meeting is available to me. So I kind of have that with me all the time. And some days I'm scrambling like mad in that toolbox to find a way out of the way that I'm feeling, because my own experiences as an addict, it's like I just hated the way that I felt. And my only way to get out of that was to get away from that feeling, you know? And, you know, a lot of using came from that. So the feeling of wanting to escape can sometimes be very, very overpowering. But I just keep reaching for my toolbox, and most of the times I do find something there that does help me through. You know, I might be feeling like absolute shite, but I can be mindful enough to know that what I'm doing, if it's taking a couple of breaths or just kind of going, Steph, just slow down, or just don't be so hard on yourself, or just stop trying to control. Mm-hmm. And just basically, I've learned over the years that tomorrow is a new day, and I won't be feeling like this tomorrow. And 9 times out of 10, that comes true. So I've kind of, with time, realized that if I just stick, if I persevere with being mindful and just kind of accepting that I'm not feeling well, but it won't last. Mm-hmm. I'm usually rewarded, you know? So that kind of gives me faith in recovery.
I think also such a big part of it is, you know, when you feel ready, when one feels ready, that we speak honestly about it and we say, you know, the substance has gone, but the feelings are still there. The scared, like you said, you know, today's not a good day. And I think the more we can say that to people who don't suffer from the same illness that we do, I think that's a good thing. And I'm so in awe of you and your honesty and the way you've spoken about it in the past and continue to speak about it. One last thing. Your son, I have a 22-year-old son. It's a really interesting thing being a parent and being an addict and having a wealth of knowledge there. How do you impart that knowledge? He's much younger than my son, but how do you start to impart that knowledge?
The one great thing that the school that he goes to, it's a state school, they have a charity called Place to Be, which is a little counseling service for kids. And they can basically sign themselves up themselves. So my son has done it a few times. He's six, and sometimes he goes with his friends. They put their name in a little box, and then on Friday they get to go see this counselor. And I say, you can tell me what you talk about there, but you don't have to if you don't want to, you know. And once he told me, it's like, yeah, we'll go in there, and, you know, because this one friend wasn't really talking to another friend of ours, so then we got a little bit sad. So we're just saying, why does he do it like that? And then they talked about it with the counselor, and they kind of resolved their big issues for them, you know. And then everything was fine. And they talk about going to see this counselor like if it's the most normal thing in the world. So when I see that, I'm like, wow, they're like miles ahead.
Absolutely.
So it's sometimes kids will actually teach you something about, you know, the things that I've grown up seeing as stigmatized and very difficult, and talking about myself and, you know, dealing with difficult emotions and issues. If, you know, they start off at a young age with that attitude that, you know, it's okay to feel and it's okay to talk about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I can't believe we're out of time, but I just want to again go back to acknowledge what you said earlier about the power of coming out, you know, as a young gay person in a very public place, and comparing that to kind of coming out and saying, listen, I've got a problem, you know, I need to do something about this. And the kind of, it just, for me, it describes the kind of the power of this condition, you know, that we have to stay secret. We can't really tell you about that part of us. I just, it always hits me every time you talk about it, actually. Stefan, before we close, is there anything else that you'd like to mention or even talk about, anything, any other organizations that have helped you along the way?
Yeah, I think we're fortunate today, both me as a musician and as someone who has experienced, you know, these issues that we've been talking about. There is help out there. There are helplines out there. Some of them are even 24 hours. There's one for musicians called Music Mind Matters. Mm. There's also one called Calm, a campaign against living miserably, who is fiercely campaigning and trying to reduce the suicide amongst especially young men in UK, because it's the biggest killer of young men. And also the Samaritans, who I reached out to many, many years ago, because that was the only one that was available, but they're still around. So these are just a few numbers you can start with if you're feeling like you don't know where to turn to. These people will listen.
Yeah, and those details will be available on the Wagon website, so people can reach out to them too if and when needed.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're out of time. I can't believe it. But I just want to shout out to Abita Calm. Without their support, this podcast wouldn't be available. Specialising in addictions and mental health. And you can find much more about them at www.abitacalm.com. And if you have enjoyed or got something from this podcast today, please sign up. And if you dare, can you give us 5 stars? It would be much appreciated. And thank you so much again to Stefan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.